welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Hello, everyone. We are continuing our series on creativity, and today we are discussing neural patterns of creativity of highly creative people like musicians, dancers, artists. And our guest today is Penny Jean Gracefire. She's a longtime investigator of EEG and designer of numerous applications of therapeutic neuromodulation. Penny Jean's interests are far-ranging, and ultimately, I think she's looking at exploring what it means to be human through an understanding of biometric data. So Penny Jean, welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Thank you for having me. I've been really looking forward to this.
Great. Now we're glad to have an excuse to bring you on. Not, I suppose that we need one. I always like to start with an origin story. So how did you get interested in this intersection of neuroscience, neural feedback, and creativity?
So this is a story I don't tell as much these days, maybe as I used to, but so I'm a licensed mental health counselor. And originally when I went into my graduate program to get licensed, I had a very strong conceptualization of what I thought my approach to therapy was going to be. And it involved a lot of glitter and squishy stickers and a lot of just kind of color. And I think I probably would have potentially even gone into like a play therapy or, you know, possibly an art therapy direction, right? Because I've been very much a fan of the arts over the years. And when I did my internship with a clinic that had neurofeedback in it, and I was introduced to the concept of biometric data, one of the things that I think has made therapy such a squishy science over the years is that we're very reliant on people to narrate their own experiences to us. And very few of us are reliable narrators. And even if we are reliable narrators of our own experience, the other thing that became clear to me at some point in this arc was that we are all constructing our experience with a very different set and arrangement of receptors of information. So even trying to have conversations between ourselves about what our experiences are can be very challenging. Because if I don't have nerves in the same places as you, if my rods and cones are not arranged similarly, if I don't have the same taste buds, if I don't have the same density and arrangement of auricular nerves, then the literal inputs coming in that create my experience of life that I construct and then attempt to communicate to you are not the same as yours.
Right.
And so there is, I think, a very natural ceiling to a lot of communication. We're going to start there, connection and communication. I think there's a natural ceiling to that when there is insufficient bandwidth, cognitive bandwidth, to hold the potential of multiple experiences with nuance simultaneously. And so when I realized a lot of us were hitting the wall very quickly with how much we could kind of think about or hold cognitively, and that the majority of sort of expression and communication that many people feel frustrated with was often a result of just not having enough range to hold both your experience and multiple other people's and then talk about that in shared vocabulary. Because again, shared vocabulary is a delightful illusion. Mm-hmm. as many therapists will know, you know, you say, the client comes in and says, I have anxiety, and you say, excellent. And you check off the anxiety box, and you think they mean something and they mean something very different. You don't find out till 6 weeks in that for them, anxiety actually meant like some subcomponent of OCD that was very clearly diagnosable if you had just had the details, right? So part of becoming a good therapist and a good provider of any type of therapeutic support, I think, requires a level of curiosity and attention that becomes a creative force, because you actually have to create, like you have to world build your sense and your sort of hologram of every single person that you work with. And you have to think about the ways that they map onto the world, the way therapy or different types of neuromodulation work. You have to think about all the ways you can get data from them. And then you have to, you know, construct that into essentially, okay, here's all the tools I have. Here's what they seem to be working with. They seem to be a little more responsive to auditory, maybe than visual feedback, but they're kind of a kinetic learner. And so you're having to creatively construct, you know, we call it like a treatment plan or like a therapeutic arc. But every treatment plan is an exercise in creativity that is only possible by gathering a bunch of data points, connecting them, and literally creating a client that you're going to work with in your own brain. That's a representation of the best that they can give you and the best you can understand. So creativity for me is always about world building, and it's always about connection and communication. And that's like just the foundation of anything else I'm going to say today.
I was going to say, it sounds like to you, the creativity is an interactive function between, in this case, between therapist and client.
Yes. This was the interaction between therapist and client was, I want to say the linchpin or the lever for me to analyze it in the ways that I have ever since. Hmm. Right. Even though I can certainly zoom out and expand the analysis to a lot of different categories, right? Because I've worked with a number of people who I would consider to be career creatives over the years in the arts, right? Or, I mean, I consider engineering to be a very creative profession. I think I'm a pretty intelligent person, but if you ask me to build a skyscraper or a bridge, yeah, I don't think anybody would be happy with the structural integrity of what you've got, right? And so I am just deeply interested in how people work, mm-hmm. and how they world build, because it's the capacity to create a connective grid of data points and then map new ideas or just new rearrangements onto that, which is essentially what we're calling creativity.
Well, I want to talk a minute then about those data points that we would look at.
Yeah.
So when you work with someone who would be considered highly creative, whether they are a singer or an engineer, are you seeing anything interesting in their EEG? Are there variations in the patterns? And does that even vary across different types of creativity?
Oh, yes. I think a couple of maybe... It is difficult to silo out or categorize out, right? Because your taxonomy will never be sufficiently granular to really represent all the variability. But there's a couple of maybe kind of main umbrellas that I often tend to pre-bin into until we've got more details, right? To give it more nuance. And so what has been very interesting is that, especially even if we think like historically about the documented mental health challenges of people we consider to be the most creative among us. And then we also consider the savant capabilities of people that we consider to be, you know, functionally challenged in other ways. Mm-hmm. The first bifurcation I think that I encounter is people who are insufficiently differentiated from their external environment, and people who are maybe more differentiated from their external environment than would be considered functional or helpful. And here's what I mean by that, right? So when we think about a person that we would maybe describe as normative, usually it's someone who has a certain amount of like social awareness. They can track things going on around them. They've got the processing speed and capability, the historical record memory to kind of learn how to interact with people, the projective capability to think about how to respond, how to arrange their face, how to arrange the vocal tones. Think about people who interact well with their environment. It's usually some combination of being somewhat quick, good memory, good attention, the creativity of being a little bit funny or well-timed or knowing when to sort of adjust, right? When to interact in a group and when to like leave space and let other people have a minute. Like these types of timings and beats, like this is the stuff that we associate it with, like a sort of a well-rounded person who can maybe perform at work, right? But we also think of that person as someone who probably has a decent schedule, probably sleeps enough, maybe does some physical, like when we associate what we consider to be like maybe a high functioning, well-rounded person, there's a number of categories where they are modulating themselves within expected productive ranges. If you've ever met somebody like that, please introduce me. I'd love to map their brain. The majority of us are kind of on one side or the other. Well, we are just a little too affected by all those incoming inputs from our external environment. We're a little too easily stressed out, hypervigilant. We cannot kind of modulate how much of our emotional response is occurring to stressors and other people, social anxiety, poor sleep because we're just thinking about things. And also this idea of being a little bit more oriented to what's happening outside of us and not as much oriented to what's happening inside of us, which is its own challenge over time, right? Other side, people who do not seem to have a lot of sensitive awareness, they get focused in on projects, maybe they can be quite particularly productive or good in some sort of maybe like local pursuits, but when you ask them to interact in a group or you ask them to like talk about their feelings, right? These are people who could have really significantly creative capabilities. But when you ask them to interact with the world at large, it's either not possible for them or it's so immediately stressful and overwhelming, they go back to the withdraw, the shutdown, and the differentiation. So there's the overly independent and the insufficiently independent stance that kind of call differentiation, right? And so our ability to be creative sometimes is fed by our constant absorption of the world around us, taking all the data points, putting them together, and reflecting them back. For other people, the lack of noise is what allows for that deeply independent kind of unique production of certain things, right? So people who are very sensitive and people who are, I would say, less sensitive can both be quite independently creative, but there's going to be a difficulty with connection on the overly differentiated side, which ultimately will make it hard for them to navigate and connect with what they create. And then there's people who are unable to sustain productivity because they are so stressed out and not okay by all the stuff they're noticing all the time with no ability to sort of put the lid on it when necessary. So there's the insensitive and the overly sensitive. We see both of those categories in people who are quite creative, right? So then that brings us essentially to, I think, maybe what the next big component is here, which is network formation and capability. So the other thing that I notice a lot in people that I would say have career creative pursuits is that often their capacity to do sort of simultaneous rapid processing is often a little bit more evolved. So there's a couple ways I'm going to say this. One is that a much more significant percentage of the population than I think is discussed or even understood does not visualize in the way that we often think about visualization. Like obviously aphantasia, the complete inability to visualize anything, is a documented and discussed iteration of humanity, right? But there are actually people who have much less gradient capacity to visualize than, I mean, honestly, at this point, probably like 30, 40% of the population that just don't have strong visualization capabilities. That's a pretty significant amount, right? And so part of what potentially affects what we would call processing speed, because there's two ways to do stuff quick, right? There's do a bunch of things at the same time, which is often what we call visualization. Hold a bunch of data points simultaneously and kind of imagine them, right? And then there's do a bunch of things in a line very quickly and maybe have multiple lines of sequential data processing. These are not the same thing. Both of them can produce very quick creative responses, right? But when you operate a certain way, it's very difficult to imagine how other people who operate are different. For example, Saul, do you dream in color?
I think that I do.
And it's even interesting that you even said, I think. Mm-hmm. If you even just open up the ball, there are people who don't remember dreaming at all. There are people who dream in black and white. There are people who dream in very distinct vivid color. There are people who lucid dream, right? There are like even just the range of sort of that like sub-post, you know, adjacent processing task that we're calling dreaming has significant variability. Mm-hmm. If I were to ask you, Saul, can you visualize, like, who was the person you would say you spend the most time looking at in any given week?
Looking at? Mm-hmm. Probably my wife.
Okay. If you were to close your eyes right now, could you clearly visualize your wife's face?
I can.
And like, you can see the features, you can kind of see, mm-hmm. you can visualize her making expressions. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who you ask them to visualize a face of someone that they see every day and they literally cannot. Mm-hmm. And then there are people in between who are like, well, I can imagine what their nose looks like, or I know what their chin looks like. Like they can focalize on like a feature or a component. Like I know what their hair looks like, right? They can focalize on that, but they couldn't do a composite face. And or they couldn't change it. Like they couldn't imagine it making different expressions. When we are thinking about holding data points of various types in our brains and then using those as reference points to then express, like this is the same with sound. Some people are absolutely cannot hear pitches and other people can hear everything to the point that it's distressing. Right. And so when we're even just like thinking like, okay, people are really good with color. Not everybody's rods and cones see the same right. colors, right? So if we're just making the foundation of, okay, there is a lot of variability in how people process and how they produce. The most interesting thing is that, so when I'm thinking through, okay, I've got someone who's very auditorily creative. I've got a musician, specifically a musician, maybe a composer, versus somebody who does visual work, someone who paints. This is going to be really different than somebody who codes. There are some gorgeously creative coders out there. But think about the mediums they're working in, right? So your original question was, what am I seeing in brain maps? The most, I think, trackable iterative differentiation is the strength of specific network connections between different areas of the brain that support types of processing. Mm-hmm. So I may see way more activity in network processing between auditory cortex and other parts of the brain when I am potentially working with a musician. Now, it's not a blanket rule. For example, I worked with someone who had synesthesia. They were a musician, but they saw the music as colors. So they had strong visualization capabilities, and I did not see the same level of me auditory network strength and activity mm-hmm. that I would see in other musicians.
Right.
Some of the athletes that I've worked with, you know, I was also kind of surprised at the visualization that came with potentially being an athlete that moved a vehicle at speed, a driver or a motorcyclist. One of the things that, I mean, obviously we think about reaction time, we think about physical core strength to manage, whether you're a car driver or riding a bike at speed. We think about things that like make that physical capacity possible, but part of what creates orientation and reaction speed is visualization. And so if you are going to ride at speed, the faster you go, the shorter space and time you have to react. And so that means your capacity to look all the way down as far as possible towards wherever you're going is going to directly affect your ability to respond, right? Mm-hmm. And so even just like the visual processing capabilities of people who move at speed can be quite different, right? Mm-hmm. Which was something I thought, oh, we're going to get that sensory motor strip. We're going to get, you know, I did not really anticipate the visualization needs for orientation and reaction time. So that lit up quite distinctly in a lot of my athletes.
Yeah, that makes sense when you as you think about it, because you need to be able to visualize what you're responding to very quickly. So when we've talked with other neurophysiologists about creativity, they've also talked about the importance of like default mode network and the executive control networks. And that's certainly implied in what you've been saying. But could you maybe speak a little bit more to those?
Yeah. So this is where probably maybe the way that I process through it even myself might be a little bit different than the norm. So I'm going to joke a little bit here about my own creative process.
Absolutely.
Because I think the foundation, so I mean, in some way, so I joke a little bit, but sometimes people say, what do you do? And I have a couple of standard jokes. I say, oh, I'm a neural frequency analyst, or I'll say, oh, I'm a frequency barista. You know, like I'll say things a little bit in jest. But the reality is, when we're thinking about the process of creation, a big part of what I contribute to the industry is taking data points that we have, rearranging them, and then creating new ways to tackle, the goal is, and my goal is always going to be, if possible, increase cognitive bandwidth, processing speed, and state flexibility. You've probably heard me throw those phrases around. They're very core for me, because I think they really underlie all of our ability to engage at all, right? So even earlier when I was talking about differentiation, I'm talking about the capacity to engage appropriately and to disengage appropriately as ways of modulating and maintaining care of your own process. And so the creativity that I am engaging in is, here is a bunch of frequencies that we think correlate. Here is a bunch of brain areas that we think are responsible for certain things. If I network some, if I make my own customized little network of brain areas together, and then I think about which frequencies that they are syncing up in or not, that's one of the things about quantitative EEG or EEG analytics, which again, I think this is something I might do a little bit differently, possibly, because of the tools at my disposal, which I will absolutely discuss in a minute. I think a lot of times what we're doing in our industry is we're doing very complex and kind of advanced analytics to then figure out the appropriate simple intervention. Mm-hmm. Here's the location. Here's a couple of frequencies we're going to try to increase or decrease at this location, maybe a couple locations. I think it is easier for me to think about it in terms of networks. And if we're going to do it that way, I think I'm almost always constructing networks out of what the QEG data has given me about the individual. Mm-hmm. So yes, default network, salient network, maybe even executive function network, which out of the three of them, probably executive function is a little bit my favorite. I'll loop back to that. Two sticky notes we've got now. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, when I'm looking at the QEG data, and I'm looking at the regional Esloretta findings, I am still mentally constructing those findings into vectors and into networks. Because what I'm really looking for is which of those networks, how are they connecting or not? How are they syncing up or not syncing up in frequency ranges? Because they need to be able to sync up in every frequency so that they can literally slide up and down the spectrum to do that engaging or disengaging that I was talking about earlier. So I'm literally looking at every frequency range in every location. I'm going, how do I see where they're having perseverance or persistence that is preventing a smooth slide, which is where I think we're going to make the most out of our biometric data. Because a quantitative EEG usually will reference, what is this brain doing based on some normative ranges that kind of tells us what we should expect. That's fine. Okay, so we get some atypical findings, right? how are we supposed to use that usefully? I think the best way to think about it is, what are the local areas that are perseverant, that are not flexibly engaging or disengaging in the ways that we would expect? That's what shows up in the reds and the blues and the Z-scores, and the whole purpose of looking at an atypical finding is being like, where's the brain perseverant? Not the same thing as persistent. Perseverant means there's insufficient change, right? Okay, we find that. And then what are we supposed to do? We can go in very focal and be like, move around, buddy. Like, increase or decrease right there. Mm-hmm. But if we're thinking about that in terms of increase and decrease, we go in, we go focal, we give it some feedback. And then we just sort of expect the rest of the network to figure out how it's going to reintegrate it back in. I think if we go ahead and build out the network and we say, hey, these are actually the frequency ranges and the other brain locations that we would like for you to be engaging with, and we make that explicitly part of the feedback paradigm, you get that local region recruited back in much more quickly with much less resistance and confusion for that recalibration reintegration. The reason I'm talking about it in these terms is because, okay, there's me trying to create feedback paradigms that will allow for this, which is why, you know, historically, as you know, I've done a lot of work on the Brainmaster platform because it allows for me to build this type of customized stuff, right? Small plug for the deeply underutilized features on that software platform, but also with the explicit understanding that for a lot of people, that is just a very stressful idea of having to customize all their stuff in nuance every single time, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, my creativity abounds when you give me all the options and none of the limits. For a lot of other people, that feels like spiraling distress and overwhelm, which is why I have spent a lot of years going, what does freedom and connection and safety feel like for other brains that don't operate like mine, mm-hmm. which has been the pursuit, right? I think that we're all kind of in, like, you think differently than me. Can we connect? And mm-hmm. what does it mean? So I'm over here building all my little fancy schmancy protocol stuff, right? Meanwhile, I'm potentially working with people. So for example, as you had asked earlier, one of my sort of more publicized cases that I worked with was the musician Dessa. She had a really interesting arc. For her in particular, she was having some autobiographical distress because she had had a relationship. They had broken up. It had been sort of a 10-year arc of relationship. They were going back and forth. She'd basically written an album of music that she was then repetitively performing about this relationship that she was also simultaneously trying to move on from. And she was essentially like, what's the play here? And so, you know, she had kind of done her own research, and how she ended up with me was just this, like, I think part of it was also even just the I would say maybe like the weirdness of the request. She'd gone through a number of other people who were like, I'm sorry, you want neurofeedback to fix your broken heart? That seems not viable. You know me, I have a hard time saying no.
You couldn't say no to that.
I was like, okay, well, what does it mean to be emotionally distraught and be revisiting the reference points that you constructed relationally in your brain and putting them to a musical pattern, which is just gonna I was like, let's assess what's going on here. And so the opportunity to map her brain, look at what was happening in the memory and autobiographical memory parts of her brain, see how the decrease and increase in sort of the responses, because I mean, we didn't just do a baseline, right? We made some conditions. We somewhat mimic the conditions under which she was, you know, she'd done an fMRI, right, of what her brain looked like when she was looking at pictures of her ex and then looking at pictures of other people that she didn't have that same emotional response to. So she had this lovely little fMRI, you know, lit up in her caudate nucleus. She had she had a couple of brain areas already. She was like, hey, listen, this is what my fMRI looked like. I was like, excellent. We know that S-Loretta correlates quite well with fMRI. So let's just take a peek at the literature and let me do a brain map where we do an S-Loretta analysis. We do a solid Loretta analysis of what we've got going on. And so I was able to construct a customized network that represented both what we were seeing in her brain data, but also represented and reflected what the literature was saying 20 years of research into what, how do people feel when they're romantically attached to someone? How is that a different brain process than being, you know, loving your child or loving your parent? Like, what's the difference between romance and friend love? So there's, these are obviously questions everyone's interested in. So there's been tons of research kind of asking that and looking at it through various different ways of imaging, even including some EEG. So I was able to take all of that and say, if I was going to build a romance network, what would it look like? Mash it to what we're seeing in her brain, her own fMRI, and then construct a protocol that said, hey, I'm looking at some persistence in a couple areas we are associating with emotional attachment, reward network, autobiographical memory, right? Let's make you your own network that combines all of this. And then let's do some feedback and see if we can move some of that local perseverance while giving it a network blueprint to map to in the process. We only did 9 sessions. And part of the reason that I'm even kind of bringing this up as an example is because it is a well-documented fact that the majority of musicians often do their best work when they're really not emotionally fine. And it's even a little bit of a joke, right? Counting Crows put out several incredible albums until Adam Duritz, the lead singer, got a girlfriend like in the early 2000s. And then there's, you know, like fandom discussion about how he fell off. And like, okay, sure, like whatever, taste is taste. But this idea that, like, if you are emotionally distressed about the world and about your relationships, you're going to do your best work because there is that drive to repair disrupted connection by trying to express yourself and your experience of what has happened in a way that you think someone could understand, whether it's your ex or like the world at large. You were trying to express, you're trying to narrate your own experience of the world. And that drive to do that often is what creates our best art. So the question then becomes, are you as driven if you are not distressed and disrupted? In Dessa's case in particular, she did her album, she went on tour. The work that we did was between her creation of the album and her going on tour. She had already performed some of her songs from the album in a few preliminary shows. And the thrust of what I had designed her protocol for was really 2 things. One was to try to address the sort of the mental and emotional perseverance that she had thinking about the person in general. But the other was the very specific emotional autobiographical recall that was happening when she was performing the music that was based on those experiences. And so that had actually been mappable under some of the test conditions we did originally, like listen to this specific song you wrote about him and think about it. You know, like we created some mappable differentiating conditions. And I could see in the literally in some of the like the temporal memory and auditory processing centers, there are very specific regions of your brain that overlap autobiographical memory and auditory processing. We could see her absolutely just like shut down in those areas under the emotional stress condition. And so that seemed like a pretty reasonable strategy to me for performance, maybe not as viable and sustainable for ongoing healing and potentially being able to have relationships in the future. So we were looking at those regions, a couple ones in the front that were relevant to, you know, like maybe that circuit between the ventral tegmentum and the amygdala and some of the orbital frontal and anterior cingulate circuits. So I was like, okay, let's take some of that, put it together and see what we can do. We did 9 sessions. We only needed 9. Because she is what I would call more on the sensitively aware end, right? It didn't take a lot of feedback for her brain to re-strategize based on those updates. Her description of the process and her outcome was that she felt like the memories and the experiences were still there, but she didn't feel the level of emotional salience and distress that she was experiencing previously when she would access them. She's like, it was there. It just wasn't as distressing and painful. Because we joked at the beginning, she was like, can you eternal sunshine of the spotless mind me? Can we just like, can we cut it out? Like, what's the game plan? And I was like, listen, you might want it later. I don't really do the surgical removal thing. But I was like, listen, it feels like it is not operating. It's not mitigating or modulating in that productive way we were talking about at the very beginning, of how easy it is for you to engage or to disengage based on what your actual priorities are. You want to be able to do a thing, your brain's not listening. How do we just complete those circuits so that you're actually able to make choices about what you want to prioritize that better reflects what your kind of your goals are and not your historical record of damage? And so that's what we did. 9 sessions later, she was like, I noticed I feel different, but it wasn't until she got back in her fMRI machine and was able to see the actual subcortical structural change when she repeated the experiment that, and again, N of 1, I saw changes in the post-EEG, she saw changes in the post-fMRI, and we were like, interesting experiment, and I was able to take that data and extrapolate towards a handful of other creative protocol designs.
Well, we're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we'll talk more about those designs and some of your favorite tools and favorite networks, and maybe about some more thoughts you have on the neurophysiology of creativity.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on Healthy Brain, Happy Body. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the subscribe here link in the show notes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, please rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get the podcast. Reviews help us reach more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.